Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. As the online world developed in the 1990s, so did a belief that such technology, if distributed evenly across communities, could be a vehicle for social equality, that if everyone had the same access to the same information, it would put everyone on an equal footing, a computer in every classroom and so forth. Virginia Eubanks believed that, and as she launched her career in Silicon Valley amid the mid to late 90s tech bubble, she saw the web as that great equalizer and a fundamental social justice issue in American cities. But by the first half of the first decade of the 2000s, she concluded her initial thoughts, well, maybe we're wrong. Today on Focus, we'll talk with Virginia Eubanks about what prompted her personal about-face and if technology can, in fact, serve social justice. It's a subject she explores in her book, Digital Dead End, Fighting for Social Justice in the Digital Age. Virginia Eubanks is an associate professor of women's studies at the University of Albany at SUNY. She'll be in town later this week as a guest of the Graduate School of Library and Information Science at the University of Illinois. She'll give a talk examining some of the issues we'll talk about here this morning on Wednesday at 5:30 at the Champaign Public Library, free and open to the public. Virginia Eubanks, welcome to Focus.
Craig Cohen, thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you with us. So, Virginia, you were a freelance web designer in Silicon Valley during the early days of the tech bubble. And as you note in your book, even then you kind of had a small sense that what you call the heady atmosphere of the dot-com boom, amid that, something was amiss. What did you sense exactly?
Well, so just a little bit of background in my sort of coming-of-age story there, I think is useful to help people understand sort of where I was coming from. So I was a sort of a political activist, and also this was a, you know, a sort of coming-of-age in Silicon Valley in the mid-90s, and this was a time where, you know, like knowing HTML was like a skill that, like, not many people had.
Right.
So I was in a really unique position, right? I was a young woman with a college education and no children. It was a really exciting time to be in San Francisco, a really exciting time to be in the Bay Area. But I was also an anti-poverty activist. And so there were all of these really high hopes about the promise of high-tech devices, computing networks, all this other stuff to democratize social relationships, to equalize class inequalities, to equalize racial and gender inequalities. But at the same time, it was really clear in the Silicon Valley, particularly in San Francisco, that if you even had the will to sort of look around for a moment, that things were changing really rapidly, and not necessarily for the better, around some of the other social justice issues I was interested in. So public housing was disappearing. Income disparities were rising really quickly, and the city really lost a lot of its vibrant diversity in that time. So, for example, the African-American population of San Francisco in 2010 was half what it was in 1980. So there was a lot of changes afoot, and it definitely led to a little bit of a crisis of confidence where I was like, wow, these tools that I really thought were going to be important for creating a sort of more just society, I'm not sure that these are working the way that I think they are. And that really led to sort of a personal crisis that led me to sort of flee across the country to this great city that I live in now, which is in upstate New York. It's Troy, New York. And then, some stuff happened here to make me rethink my rethinking even more. But definitely, it was a really exciting time to be in the Bay Area, but also really complicated.
I wonder, though, I imagine you were probably not alone when it came to that sort of feeling of, oh, we've come here to Silicon Valley, we're starting up all of these great websites and services and concepts, and I'm sure for some people, part of the motivation was, this will be a way to even the playing field for lots of folks.
Sure. And that was very much the sort of rhetorical drumbeat, was like, this, not only are we all going to make $1 million, but it's going to make the world a better place. So there was this very nervous joke that got told at parties a lot in the mid-90s in San Francisco, and you would go and meet new people, and they'd sort of like half chuckling be like, so, have you made your first million yet? And everybody would like laugh, like, oh, ha-ha, isn't that funny? But, because we were sort of ironically aware enough to know that that was supposed to be a joke, but it kind of wasn't, right? So there was this, I think it was this real interesting indicator of nervousness around this idea that we kept spouting, which was, okay, everybody's going to do really well, and also also we're going to, you know, do away with racial inequalities and class inequalities and educational inequalities. So we're going to change the world for the better and also make a bunch of money doing it. And so I've increasingly difficult ideas to hold in your head at the same time as the 90s progress.
So why didn't it work?
Wow, that's a great question. Well, I think one of the things that I say in the book is that I think that we sometimes have a kind of magical thinking around technology, that we have a tendency. So magical thinking is this this sort of process that's common in very small children and schizophrenics. And the idea is that if you wish for something hard enough, you know, if you go to sleep at night and close your eyes and think pony, 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 like in the morning there'll be a pony, right? So that's magical thinking. The idea is if you think hard enough, you can materialize your desires just sort of magically, you know, out of thin air. And I think this says really good things and really troubling things about us as a country and as a culture, that we have this kind of magical thinking around technology. On one side, you know, we're thinking this is going to enrich democracy. This is going to end poverty. This is going to, bridge these cultural divides. And that's really exciting and really, really good. It says great things about sort of our spirit and what we want. The not great thing about magical thinking is we're not real good at connecting the dots between this sort of world that we want and the one we have now. And what magical thinking can make us do is ignore the realities of the world around us in favor of the picture of the world that we want. And I think that's what I was doing, is that I thought, you know, this world that we can create, these experiences that I've had can help us create that. But I wasn't listening very well to people around me. And I think that's the really big lesson of this book, is how to listen to people whose experiences are different than yours in order to create a sort of more robust idea of what a more just, more fair, more equitable world can look like.
All right, so let's talk about some of those folks that that you have met along the way that have sort of influenced your thinking about whether or not technology, the internet, various technological developments really serve social justice. In your book, you describe the impact that a YWCA group has had on you. The group called Women at the YWCA Making Social Movement, or WIMSIM. Okay, so tell me a little bit about the women in that particular group.
Yeah, so this book very much belongs to this community of women as well as me. One of the things that's unusual about the book is that it's, for an academic book at least, is that it's based on 4 years of what's called participatory action research, which basically just means that I did a kind of research where you research with people rather than on them. And so this whole project was collaboratively created by a community of women who live in the YWCA of Troy, Cahos. And the Y is a really interesting organization. So on one hand, it's this women's membership movement that's dedicated to the empowerment of women and girls and the elimination of racism by any means necessary. And on the other hand, it's also a residence. So there's 90 folks, most of them poor and working class women, who live in basically sort of single room occupancy type housing at the Y. And so this was a really terrific organization. It's an organization that was sort of geared towards social justice and had that framework for me coming in, and had a sort of like a really strong, a robust, resourceful community of women there who really were interested in taking on these issues and thinking through them with me. So I'm very, very, very lucky, and I always try to say, like, this book is not just my book, it's our book. And WIMSIM, this organization, was a really big part of it.
So what did you learn from these women that you didn't understand before?
Well, so when I entered the community, I had in my head this sort of framework that is probably really familiar to most of your listeners, which is this idea of the digital divide. So the idea of the digital divide is basically that there are this group of people, technological haves, who have all the stuff, right? They've got all the goodies. They've got laptops, they've got smartphones, they've got, access to broadband, all this stuff. And on the other side, there are technological have-nots who don't have those things. And so then the social justice goal there, if that access divide is a problem, is basically to either pull people from the have-not side over to the have side, or to throw stuff over the divide, you know, throw laptops and computer connections over the divide so that they can access those resources, build job skills, you know, create robust social networks.
So this is just like, you know, in the 90s, a computer in every classroom. These days,
exactly.
Broadband access for everyone. That's those goals, basically, again, trying to sort of level the playing field.
Exactly. And I can talk more about this in a minute, because I think those goals are actually really important. But because I was so fixated on this idea of access, I was actually really missing what women in the YWCA community's real experiences were. So I'll just give you an example or two. So, for example, like one of the things we were supposed to be doing at the Y was providing job training so that women could get into the high-tech economy, right? This is a great hope of struggling Rust Belt and upstate towns like mine, is to get ourselves into the high-tech economy and create some kind of job growth. And our job at the Y, we saw it initially as creating job training so women could sort of bootstrap themselves into the high-tech economy. But once I managed to sort of find the space to listen a little bit better to people's actual experience, what I found is about two-thirds of the women who lived at the Y were currently in or already had high-tech jobs. The issue was that they were high-tech jobs like in call centers, data entry warehouses, and other kind of jobs that had very inadequate wages, where the jobs were temporary, unsustainable, they had lots of negative health impacts, and they were really rigorously monitored and surveyed by their bosses. So it wasn't necessarily that they needed to get into the high-tech industries, but that the jobs they had in the low-wage high-tech sector weren't supporting them, right? So that's a different kind of an understanding of, rather than saying, like, oh, all we have to do is sort of get the gates to paradise open and make sure that people know where they are and then everything will sort of work out. Fact is, they were women in the YWCA community are already in the high-tech economy. Some of them are working these sort of more directly technological jobs like call centers and data entry. And then many of the others are also providing the services that support the high-tech economy. So at least in Troy, when we talk about the high-tech economy, we also often leave out the fact that like 80% of the growth in this economy is actually in the service occupation. So
go ahead.
It's a different kind of an idea.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned this idea of service occupations, because it's not just data processing. It's not just call centers. Pretty much anywhere I think you look in society within the service sector, you see technology. I mean, I think about just going through the drive-through.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are, of course, you know, they've got computers set up not just to place your order, but to time how quickly it takes for a car to get from that spot where they're ordering to the point where they actually deliver the food. And the whole point of that is to try and create more efficiency and get the folks that are you know, working the drive-through to move faster.
Right.
But does it add to a sort of atmosphere of sort of Big Brother watching you all the time?
Well, it's interesting. One of the stories that I got told a lot was a lot of the women who lived and worked in the Y community also worked for, they would be in inputting insurance claims or like working for large data entry companies. And one of the stories that one of the women I worked with told was one day she was looking. She was trying to figure out if she had enough money in her sort of bank account to go get a sandwich at lunch. And so she pulled up the internet for a minute, and she went to look at her bank account. And in her own words, like in less than a minute, the, quote, bloodhounds from the IT department were at her desk and saying, like, what are you doing? This is company time. Like, you can't go on the internet. We're going to dock you 5 minutes. And she's like, I'm just trying to figure out if I have enough money for a sandwich. And they're like, this is you. You know, you can't use the internet on company time. So basically this idea that particularly the lower down on the sort of wage scale you are, the more and more attention is paid to the work you're doing. And that's facilitated by these high-tech tools, right? So there's stroke counters and the folks who were entering bids for insurance companies, for example, there would be at the bottom of their screen like a number of the maximum number of bids a day that people had done that week, and you were always trying to sort of aim for that number, and it was really highly inflated so that you would be encouraged to go faster and faster and faster and faster. So there's all these tools that create a very tense, a very stressful job environment for people who don't have a lot of power around how they make use of their time at work.
Well, and this again reminds me, I'm sorry I'm going back to fast food, but I have
that's a great example.
I want to give a specific example. One day I was driving through a Burger King drive-through in another part of the country. And when I got up to the window to receive the food, the guy at the drive-through asked me if I could back up and drive past their sensor again, which would sort of game the system to demonstrate to them that they're actually serving another customer. And he'd give me free French fries if I would do this.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I thought, okay, well, that's sort of an example. Somebody's trying to game the system as almost maybe a reaction to that lack of trust between the company that's hired them and, you know, and what they really think they'll do. But then also, it also reminded me that maybe it was proof that that lack of trust was warranted. But doesn't it create that sort of environment?
Right. So I think as creative as employers and managers can get using technology to survey people at work and to try to get more efficiency out of them, the workers are going to be equally creative in finding ways to eke out little degrees of freedom, right? And whether that's just like, you know, the tiny resistance of like, could you just back up and come up again, or it's more complicated, I think that that's, maybe that's human nature, like just in that push and pull. And I think a lot of us, not just folks who have service occupations and low-wage, high-tech occupations, a lot of us who don't have complete control over the way we choose to use our time at work or how decisions are made at work, a lot of people can relate to this. It's not just poor and working-class folks who are experiencing this, but I think a lot of the they are canaries in the coal mine, right? They are like the first sort of test population because they have less power and less authority on the job. So a lot of things get sort of tested out on poor and working people before they find their way to middle class and professional middle class folks.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest this hour is Virginia Eubanks, Associate Professor of Women's Studies at the University of Albany at SUNY. She's the author of Digital Dead End, Fighting for Social Justice in the Digital Age. She'll be here in Champaign-Urbana later this week as a guest of the Graduate School of Library and Information Sciences at the University of Illinois. She'll participate in workshops on campus and give a free lecture open to the public at the Champaign Public Library on Wednesday at 5:30. We're discussing whether technology can serve social justice. And to join us on air, we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, and we will go first to Michael in Effingham. Good morning, Michael.
Yes, thank you. And I'll add on, my last name is Strange, which is an old English name. But nevertheless, my question and comment is about the advancement of the capitalist paradigm just as it was at the turn of the Industrial Revolution. And those things have been persistent, in my opinion, that it is always the worker is another form of raw material and one that is exploitable. And how that is done and the things I've read, and I'm 78 years old and I have lived a long time in the process of trying to make a living, and which is wide, you know, it's all around the earth. I mean, the thing is it in Western Europe and then into the U.S., and now it's around the world. And the human labor means nothing except the exploitation of it from those that possess it, that turns into money for those who possess the money. So it's still a class society. And if I could, one last thing, example I'll use is the Frederick Engels, one of his pieces, I think, is the working class in Europe, and the steam engine was the big thing, and the someone had to watch a gauge that showed how hot, you know, the steam pressure. So they employed a 9-year-old boy, and the foreman said, "You stand here and look at that needle, and when that needle gets to the point that I'm pointing to, you pull this trip." And the boy stood there, and he did his work, and they checked on him. And then the foreman the next day came back, and the boy was sitting on the floor with a string attached to his toe to the pull line. And when it got to a certain point, all he had to do was move his foot, and he was sitting down. Well, I use that as example as the technology that that existed at the time, and how the worker was involved, even this 9-year-old boy. So that is a as an example. But now that your guest mentioned about someone wanting to see how much money they had to get a sandwich, and immediately somebody comes out and docks them. And if that is, so it tells me nothing has changed.
All right.
All right, awesome. Ring off and thank you.
Thank you very much for the comment there, Michael. We appreciate it. Virginia, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I really appreciate Michael calling in. I think two things. I think things have changed somewhat. And I think that one of the things that's really important to think about, and I think this is kind of what Michael is suggesting too, is how sort of what sociologists would call social location, which just means sort of like where you are in a position of power in society, like your race and your class and, you know, your control over your own decision making and things like that, how much that matters to your experience of technology. So this is one of the big lessons of the book, too, is that, so in my case, so I'm a, you know, middle-class, professional, white woman, American woman in middle age, and, you know, frankly, technology really helped me in a lot of really important ways. And there's some annoyances about it, but, you know, it facilitates my job. It makes it easier to be mobile, but continue to be in touch with my students and my research. It eases my relationship with government. Like, you know, I don't have to go to the DMV. I can just re-register my pickup online. Like, all of this stuff actually really facilitates some great things in my life. So I don't want to say, you know, like, technology is the boogeyman and it's out to get you. I don't think that's very useful either. It's equally unuseful as saying it's going to fix everything. But what really does matter is sort of where you are in relationship to the technology. So where, for example, where technology and the internet makes my relationship to governance, to government and to the state easier, the women in the YWCA community had a much more complicated relationship to it, because one of the places where they came in contact with technology most regularly was in the social service office.
Yeah, could you describe the role technology plays in the welfare system?
Yeah, so since the welfare reforms of 1996, one of the things that's been there's been two things really on the mind of government around welfare. One is what they call moving people from welfare and into work. It's a little complicated about whether that's actually happening or not, but that's what the goal is. And the second is making the provision of welfare more efficient. And one of the ways that they try to increase efficiency is by using computers to do some of the decision-making around who has access to social services and how. So a lot of the women who I talked to who had come into contact with technology in the social service office would tell me that they would, you know, arrive at the office out of some really dire emergency, right? Like escaping a relationship that involved domestic violence because they were homeless, because they had no food and nothing to feed their children, right? So these very, very, very tense, life-critical moments. And they would arrive at the Office of Social Services, and they would go to speak to a caseworker, and the very first thing that they would encounter would be the sort of back of a computer terminal. And the caseworker would often sort of hide behind the computer terminal so they wouldn't have to make eye contact with them. And they would just say, like, you're not in the system. Or, you know, fill out this, at, like in Rensselaer County where I live, the intake form for welfare is 37 pages long, right? So fill out this form, you know, hand it in, we feed it into the computer, and you'll hear from us, you know, by mail in three to eight weeks, right? So if this is where people are coming into contact with technologies of the state, then one of the questions I ask in the book is, like, what kind of lessons about government do people take from that? And also, how does that affect welfare caseworkers, frontline welfare caseworkers' jobs as well? So this was something that I didn't expect to see at all, and it was really not my personal experience. And I think that's one of the reasons it's really important to do this kind of engagement, this thinking around technological citizenship with people whose experiences are not like our own, because a lot of this stuff can be very unexpected, I think.
We're talking with Virginia Eubanks, Associate Professor of Women's Studies at the University of Albany at SUNY. She's the author of Digital Dead End, Fighting for Social Justice in the Digital Age. We're discussing if and how technology and social justice intersect. We're due for a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, back with Virginia Eubanks, Associate Professor of Women's Studies at the University of Albany at SUNY. She's the author of Digital Dead End, Fighting for Social Justice in the Digital Age. And we will go next to Scott in, I believe, Covington, Indiana. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I just I wanted to comment that I'm getting old and grumpy, but to me, I see all this technology coming and coming and coming, and it seems like all it ever does, it's like the real early adopters at some point seem to gain a little bit from it, but it always seems like as it goes on and on and on, basically all it really does is shuffle the deck for everybody, and it just seems like it gets filled in with more work. I mean, I know some people I'm a farmer, but I know people that, you know, work in business, and it always just seems like sooner or later it just comes to the point where they just pile more impossible stuff on you. And I guess I'd say, like, the cell phone for me, all it has made, really, it seems like it's just made it possible nobody ever sets an appointment a day in advance. I mean, it's just well, you can call somebody a half an hour before you have to be there and, you know, cancel or, you know, make other plans. It almost seems to me like it's, in the end, when it's the technology, when it gets mature, people don't use it anymore for, you know, to make things work better. It just seems like in the end, it's like you're running around as much as you did before with, and it seems to me like a lot of technology writers are predisposed to defend the technology and not really say, you know, well, maybe it's easier to do this DMV stuff, but maybe before this technology, DMV didn't expect you to do some of this stuff that they say now, well, it's easy to do, so we'll add a little more on. Do you get the gist of my comment or complaint?
Yeah, absolutely. And as a teacher at a state university who, when the semester is in, gets like 200 emails a day from students who are like, where's the library? Oh, wait, I found the library. Where are the books that I need in the library? Oh, no, wait, I found them. Okay, where is the – and it's like, no, you can do this on your own.
Right.
Like, you're a little grown-up.
I'll just hang up and listen. You got my comment. Thank you.
Thanks so much for calling.
All right, thanks very much for that call. And we'll go next to Kathy in Pontiac. Kathy, good morning.
Hi. I'm a librarian in a small rural library up in Odell, Illinois. And we've just been awarded what they call an EDD grant, Eliminating the Digital Divide. And that is a grant to try to help smaller communities get people internet service, you know, have them come into the library, be able to use computers, and show them some basics. We're going to use it to help with job searches for people because so many of them have to apply online these days. And, you know, in our rural communities, one of my pet peeves is they're just closing all the offices, the welfare services, children's services, unemployment offices. You have to go to Bloomington or do it online, and a lot of people don't have access or the knowledge. So libraries are one place that can help with that, and hopefully, I don't know if you know anything about that grant or if you can tell us ways we can help, because we're in every community almost.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, thanks very much for that call. Any further thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm so glad Kathy called, because I've been touring around the book a lot and talking to people in a lot of different communities, and I sort of realized on my last tour a couple of events into it that at some point in the talk I could like look up and say like, where's my radical reference? And some like little group of radical librarians would like giggle and wave from the corner. So I'm a huge fan of librarians. And I think that libraries play such an important role in doing the kind of work that I used to do in community technology centers. So there were these sort of standalone organizations that were popular in the early 2000s and were funded by the federal government called community technology centers that acted to do some of this training, preparation, and access stuff that has mostly fallen on libraries now. And I think that it's an amazing role that librarians can play in keeping access to public services open, keeping access to education and jobs open. So I think that's incredibly important. I am concerned that often people think that that because of the internet, libraries aren't as important or don't need as much support. So I'll just tell you a local story. There's a local political figure who kicked up a big fuss around a library funding initiative here in Troy, New York, a couple of years ago. And one of the things he said in the newspaper was, you know, since the internet, I don't see why people have to use libraries anymore. So, you know, if the and this is almost a direct quote, if the choice is between buying a new snowplow and funding the library, you know, I just don't see how that's a choice. Of course, you're going to get the snowplow. And of course, he's wrong. Actually, since the mid-90s, library use is like doubled. Public library use has doubled. And part of it is because that is a place where people are accessing technology. So I just think libraries play such an important role in that. It's really good to hear that there's things like this EDD grant, because we can't expect librarians to just sort of pick up the really huge job of training people to use technology and making access available to folks, like on top of all the other things that they do. So it's good to know that there's some funding for that. So supporting those kinds of initiatives, I think, is really, really critical, really crucial.
There were a couple of the calls earlier sort of reminded me that we've sort of been circling around this one basic concept, which maybe is at the heart of what you're talking about in your book and what you've been examining in recent years, which is whether or not these advances in technology have taken into account the human beings that use them and how they use them, and whether or not it actually adds convenience, or is convenient maybe for somebody else but not for them.
Right.
Is that kind of the bottom line? It's a question of sort of taking into account the humanity, the people that are really at the heart of using this technology?
Yeah, so the way that I say it in the book, there's a great guy who's a critical theorist of technology named Andrew Steinberg, and he has this great line, which I'd love to repeat, so I'll give it to you guys too. But the idea is that technology is not a destiny, it's a site of struggle. So that's the part of magical thinking that's a problem, is that we think about, remember 2001, A Space Odyssey?
Sure.
In that movie, there's the monolith, right, this big black stone that just kind of falls out of the sky. And when it hits the Earth, like, there's that moment where people go from being monkeys to people, right? And so it's like the technology falls from the sky, and bam, you know, evolution. And I think we tend to think of technology that way, when in fact it's a series of choices about, you know, like what that are more complicated about what kinds of technology for who. Who have you talked to when you designed it? You know, whose interests are being served by the context in which it's being developed and implemented. So that all these things really matter. It's not just technology, yes or no. It's not technology, you know, going to save us all or going to kill us all. But it's all just much more complicated and I think much more interesting. So, you know, is the infrastructure public or private? Right, for example, makes a really big difference in the kind of technology we get. You know, that people's experiences of technology are uneven, are not all the same. That things that can make me feel very liberated and free and mobile and empowered may have a different impact on other people. Like, that really matters. So what we did was we created a way of thinking about technology and a way of particularly of thinking together about technology that we call popular technology. And the idea of that is to create spaces where we can all sort of share our experiences of living in the technological present, right? We're all experts at this. And figure out ways to sort of push these developments in the direction of social justice, to sort of tip the balance. And that's one of the things we're doing in coming to Urbana and Champaign is on Saturday at the Douglas Branch Library, a colleague of mine and I will be holding what we call a popular technology workshop. And the idea will be to think about how to use technology to serve social justice in your community, particularly around sort of economic human rights. So one of the things that I think is really important is that I don't come across as just saying like, oh, technology bad. But we can. We just have to be thoughtful about how we use it. And so the second half of the book is all about how do you develop these popular technologies? How do you develop technology for people? And that's what we'll be doing on Saturday from 10 to noon at the library.
You also have to be careful about using 2001 as a metaphor here because, of course, the HAL 9000 computer came from right here at the U of I. in the Arthur C. Clarke novel and in the movie. That said, this is also where Mosaic comes from,
right.
And in the real world. And you write in Digital Dead End that, I'll quote you here, too often science and technology policy scholars see the domains of IT and social policy as distinct, denying that studying economic, political, and social inequality is integral to the studies of science and technology. As I said, science and technology is kind of big here on the U of I campus. Do you think this is something that needs to be resolved, say, on college campuses or just in society in general?
I think that this separation that we tend to make in our heads of science from society, and under science I'm also going to sort of include technology, and my little science and technology scholar friends can yell at me later. but this separation of science from society I think is dangerously short-sighted. So I had a great advisor, David Hess, back in my grad school days, who used to say that like society is not the weeds that we have to pull out of the garden of science. It's the dirt, right? It's what everything grows out of. And that science and society are just deeply implicated in each other. And social justice is not going to happen by accident. It's not going to be the sort of unintended consequences of the next killer app, you know, whether that's nanotechnology or Twitter, right? We have to plan for it, and we have to build towards it. So there's sort of good news and bad news in the book. The good news, well, the bad news is that, you know, technology, that the Twitter did not start the Arab Spring. Like, it just didn't. It was an important tool, but it didn't start the revolution. You know, the good news is that we do that. The people of Tunisia and Egypt did that. And so I think that if we see technology as, and science, honestly, as a site of struggle rather than as a destination, as an endpoint, then we can just be more critical about the relationship of science and technology in society and make more just technology and a more just world.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guest is Virginia Eubanks, Associate Professor of Women's Studies at the University of Albany at SUNY. She's the author of Digital Dead End, Fighting for Social Justice in the Digital Age. We're talking about technology and social justice, and we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Next up is Paul in Champaign County. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. This is very complicated, but I wanted to, you'd said a little bit about the threat of sort of data mining and the amount of control of analysis that can be done of our everyday lives. And we've seen abuses of this via the Occupy movement and peace movements around the country that have been analyzed and surveilled when it's probably a waste of FBI time, because these people are definitely, if they just concentrate on the ones that are potentially violent. But I wanted to, in Champaign-Urbana, we have this example of the two. It is the center of a big node. And the effort to deal with the digital divide in the rolling out of fiber optic connectivity with the UC2B is, I think, also connected to the data mining, because SAIC and River Glass, a name that doesn't really tell you what they're doing, they're a big data mining outfit, sort of a subsidiary of SAIC, they benefit from this, you know, duplicity of connections to the Internet, too, that the UCTB is offering. So we have this example of where you're going to be going in the neighborhood of Douglas Park, of people being connected from their homes, which is a great thing. But again, the large corporate interests are benefiting, and you know, this isn't people that we're attracting to the business community. These are people already here who really aren't throwing much into the kitty to pay for this connectivity and to pay for it. And they're basically, it's a complicated story. But I hope you have a time to look into it before you arrive here, because it adds a dimension to the whole. The argument about digital divide, and the other point is this threat of the ubiquity of data mining and its sometimes misuse.
Thanks so much for calling. I hope that you or someone else who knows about the UC2B project can make it to the Saturday workshop. I think it'd be really important to have people talk about that a little bit, because I know so little about your local issues around this. I think there's some really interesting legal issues that are being raised around, like, what you do with due process when it's so easy to collect digital information about people. So there's a great scholar named Danielle Keats-Citron, I believe, who's written about what she calls digital due process. We have to figure out some new ways to think about law. In the age of, CompStat, which is the computer system that, or the computer and administrative system that runs the New York City police force, for example. And there's some real interesting issues around that activists have taken up around stop and frisk and other practices that have been part of that. But it raises some really, really, really important legal issues that we're going to have to be really thoughtful about. Before we just sort of unquestioningly support this. I think it's the same for the medical field. I think it's the same for education. It just raises some really important new issues about what it means to be a citizen and a participant in a community, in the age where so much of our life is caught up in these networks.
We have an email from Jim. He says, this technology tsunami is going to continue, and social justice is at the focus of what we're working on. No one wants to exploit the worker, but instead get rid of the work. He says, we will invent and perfect the vegetable picker, the automatic burger cook, and provide education via the web. There will be plenty of things to do, but they won't be what we used to do. People need to continue to adapt and adapt and adapt. What about that?
Yeah, so this is the idea of creative destruction, right? And I think that there's some really important truths to that. I think at the same time, we have to think about people's ability to adapt being constrained in certain ways by their social position. So, for example, one of the things that I was surprised at in the YWCA community was that I just assumed people wouldn't have a lot of technology skill or a lot of technology education. And in fact, there were two women who lived at the Y who had been computer programmers sort of in the time of COBOL, right? Like, so really ancient programming languages, you know, in sort of technology time. But what had, among the things that had happened to them is that they had had children and come out of the labor force for a while. And then by the time they got back in the labor force, by the time their children were okay on their own, or they had, you know, good quality child care, they had fallen behind, right? And so this mandate to self-train can really become an issue for people who are responsible for other people, whether that's elder care or child care or community work, right? Because it puts another burden on workers who are already stretched in a lot of directions.
Are you saying then that when it comes to poor and working class women, that it's not so much that the onus is on them to integrate themselves into the information economy, but in fact it's the economy itself that needs to find room for them?
Absolutely. That that we need to, and that was my mistake, I think, early on in the process, is this idea of providing women with the tools to bootstrap themselves into the high-tech economy. The way I started looking at it after working in the Y community was, how do we change the information economy so it supports the fullest possible future for all people? And I don't think that's the kind of question we're asking ourselves right now.
We have just a minute or so left. You say that we all have a stake in the creation of a more just information age. Why, and what, in your opinion, should we all do about it?
So there's a 9-point plan in the back of the book, which goes into this in much more depth. And so I want to tell people that they can find that online at digitaldeadend.com or at your public library. The sort of short version of that answer is the 9 points sort of fall into three categories for me, and it's about protecting workers and families in the new economy, and that's, you know, through paying attention to wages, respecting and rewarding the work of care, maybe thinking about the way that we provide subsidies to high-tech industry, and thinking about whether that math is actually makes sense, whether it's worth it. The second set of things are about protecting places, both sort of environmentally and culturally. So one of the things we haven't had a chance to talk a lot about today is the sort of environmental impacts of the high-tech economy, which are particularly sort of severe at the very beginning and at the very end of the product cycle, so where things are produced and where they are eventually disposed. And also I talk a lot in the book about democratizing the production of knowledge, so thinking about building sort of creative community institutions for thinking about what it means to be a critical technological citizen, thinking about what it means to be a citizen who's thinking about social justice in the times that we live now. And actually, technology has been a really great help in creating these kinds of popular technology programs that we're that we're going to talk about during the workshop. And I just want to give people a couple of sort of hopeful examples if I have a minute.
Yeah, just a few more seconds, but go
fantastic.
Ahead.
So one is the Detroit Digital Justice Coalition, I think, is doing really terrific work around this. They do these great things called discotechs, which are like sort of technology discovery workshops that they take into neighborhoods in Detroit. The University of the Poor and Uni Nomad, which is in Italy, are both ways to rethink education in universities when we're sort of globally interconnected. And then there's work that I'm doing with an organization that I helped found called Our Knowledge, Our Power, to help collect testimony about the violations of people's economic human rights in the United States and share those stories through in-person events and through the Internet. And people can learn more about that at populartechnology.org.
All right, then we're going to have to leave it there. Virginia Eubanks is Associate Professor of Women's Studies at the University of Albany at SUNY. She'll be at U of I in Champaign-Urbana and give a talk Wednesday at 5:30 at the Champaign Public Library on technology and social justice. The lecture is free and open to the public. Virginia Eubanks, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today's show was produced by Travis Stancil. Jason Croft was at the controls today. I'm Craig Cohen.